So thanks for coming on, Kurt. I don't know necessarily where to begin. I just met you in a parking lot moments ago, waved you in across the street, and we're happy to have you here. But what's going on, man?
So we got an email saying, hey, you want to come on this podcast? And I was like, hey, I've seen those TikToks.
Yeah. And when you saw those TikToks, what was your natural feeling?
Oh, I thought they were funny.
Okay.
So I actually take a bunch of improv in Chicago. And so I'm very, like, humor is just my weakness.
Wait, are you based in Chicago?
Yeah, for now. Moving to New Orleans soon.
New Orleans?
Yeah.
Oh, dude, this is going to be, dude. We're not going to talk about Flyd IO at all.
That's fair.
Because I have a note that you play the tuba.
I did used to play the tuba, yeah. It's been a while.
Okay, because if you're going to New Orleans, one thing about New Orleans, having lived in New Orleans, it is the only city in America where you will hear the tuba once a day.
It's true. That's why we're moving, honestly. No.
It's a huge reason. It's absolutely
yeah,
wonderful
the music
place.
There is that big.
So, okay, we're building out our new studio and office space in Chicago.
Yep.
For those listening, we're in Miami right now. We're in our local studio, but we're going to be building out in Chicago. It's a great city.
It is. Also love Chicago.
It's a great city. It's a city that works.
It's the
old school slogan.
Excellent.
The food is excellent.
Expensive food. Cheap food.
You get it all.
Yeah.
Yeah, Chicago's one of those places where you slowly miss New York a little less.
Right.
You're like, I don't need to be in New York for this. This is cleaner and a little cheaper. All right.
When you live in Chicago, you go to New York and you're like, why is there garbage on the sidewalks?
Yeah, I don't understand.
There's no alleys.
Right. Chicago, you have the alley system where all the nasty stuff gets tucked around the corner.
Just pretend it's not there.
Right. Like all the other things in Chicago that we won't talk about.
Right, exactly.
Pretend it's not there.
Lots of pretending it's not there.
Yeah. So, okay, you're headed, why New Orleans?
Working at a remote company, or like founding a remote company, is interesting because you're really not tethered to a city. And I used to have to spend a lot of time in San Francisco, and in COVID, I was like, well, it's not worth it. It doesn't matter anymore. And so we... when you're kind of freed up to live where you want, it becomes an interesting choice. So it's really like 12 reasons. And so we've got some family there, and that's important. A house came up for sale, like right down the block from them.
Okay.
But we also tend to try to move instead of traveling.
So Flyd IO is completely decentralized.
Yeah. We're like wildly remote. We have people in South Africa. We have people in South America. There's like 65 of us in probably 25 different countries.
65 people all over the world.
Yep.
How do you manage a team that's so disparate across all time zones? What's the strategy there?
I don't know yet, but so far we've been working. Our last company was remote before COVID, which was rarer. And we have some ideas and we have some things that seem to work, but it's an effort. It's like a grind to make it work well. I think in a way that being co-located doesn't make you feel so, like, you have to be very intentional about like how you set expectations for people. Mm-hmm. What you kind of want from them. And then there's this whole element of work has to happen. You have to have people make independent decisions and make good choices, but also work well asynchronously with other people. So one of the things we've been hammering on is this whole idea of, like, don't wait for consensus, just do things and do
it. Because you almost can't wait for consensus.
You can't, so slow. You would die. It wouldn't work at all in this kind of environment. We actually, I don't know how much you know about software development in general, but it actually becomes very similar to how, like, open source projects work, where you have kind of a shared place to work. There's a lot of writing, and mostly people are doing kind of small units of work in a way that is less risky, and it gets in front of other people quicker.
It's less risky because it's segmented off into a corner that they're working on. So if there was an issue, the entire infrastructure wouldn't crumble.
Yeah, exactly. I would say it's less technically risky for that reason, less business risky. So one of the things we hammer on people is to put their work in front of users, which it's probably not all that different than what you do, where it's like just getting things out in front of the people who care about it all the time
and getting feedback
and then adjusting to that is like the only, I think it might actually make us a better company because we're having to be forced to do this.
Rapid iteration.
The jury's out. Right now we're just really good at raising money and less good at turning into a huge viable business.
I see, Kurt, People, describe what that means to folks who haven't gone through a program like a YC and raised their first slug, meaning like it's not the way that this process that you're building this iteration, right? This is very different than bootstrapping in your basement, and it's capital intensive. You need to hire a lot of people before necessarily you're pulling in the revenue that's naturally supporting the business. So walk me through that, because people don't understand. Like, there's two ways to, well, there's a million ways to build a business, but this is one of
those.
This
is a very distinct. So actually the last company we did was closer to bootstrapped, where we kind of worked on interesting projects. And then one of them just accidentally became successful. We didn't really have to, we didn't decide to create a startup. We worked on a product. People started paying for it. Revenue started happening. We did go raise money to try and accelerate it faster, but it was always a very small kind of vision. So we would basically put still incremental, but we grew that to like $15 million of revenue. And then what I found, we sold that company to IBM. And then what was interesting was this was the first company I've deliberately tried to start as a startup. Everything else has been, I've had lots of failed attempts at things, but it's all been much smaller and much more bootstrappy. And what we did this time that worked unintentionally.
I trust you a lot more now, just so you know. Like,
all the companies failed?
No, I trust people that have had a lot of contact with reality and have lived bootstrap, because... Yeah. I don't know. I'm a little skeptical of those that are just really good at raising shit tons of money on crazy ideas. Yeah.
No, it's especially with like the wave of crypto stuff. You got a lot of like serious grift. You got a lot of people doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And I think that we're old and jaded. And
I love it.
I'm very cynical about startups.
You're a man after my own heart, Kurt. That is the one. That's how I like to hear it. So,
this company started with funding, because I found that when you sell your company, investors just write you basically a blank check for your next.
They're like, you do this again.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, no, we'll just fund whatever you're doing. I was like, I haven't even told you. It's like, that doesn't.
They're like, fine. Just take the money, asshole. Yeah.
And so we did, but this is 2017, and then it was like,
okay,
and it didn't work, and it just kept not working.
Yeah,
And it took us 3 years to figure out the kind of the right product, we think, for the big market we were after. And then for us, the funding came because of the market size, and because we kind of have some proof that we're basically competing with Amazon. And what happened is investors started buying that this was true and not just a stupid thing to be saying.
I see.
Yeah. It got to be a very interesting thing for them. And so we raise money now because this is one of those companies that if it's successful, it's like unlimited value. The upside is not, there's not like, usually they talk about TAM, like the total addressable market.
Yeah.
And companies pitch like, well, this could be a $1 billion company in some days. And then if you're actually credibly competing as Amazon, it's $1 trillion. It's like actually it's such a big thing that investors are like, I got to gamble on this.
I see.
Because if it goes well, it's a FOMO problem, basically. They don't want to miss out on this if it works, even though it probably won't. Basically.
Right. Well, it's a roulette spin with a 20,000 to one odd,
yeah, exactly.
Right? It's like, if you win so big, you never have to play ever again for the rest of your life.
Yes, exactly.
Basically. And what you're building is, I'm going to fuck this up and then you're going to correct me. You're building co-located servers.
All over the world.
All over the world?
Yes. The fundamental problem we're solving is the speed of light is too slow.
Meaning fiber optic.
Yeah. So from here to Sydney and back is like 400 milliseconds. And
lag.
Yeah, a lag. Exactly. So if you've ever played a game, that's like entirely unacceptable. But it's actually
unacceptable. How about if you've ever built trading systems?
Oh, yeah, like exactly. Oh, my God. That's a whole different scale.
Yeah, we dug
latency.
Up.
We have an issue.
Yeah, we would dig up holes underneath the exchange and run our own fiber.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember reading about, I used to work for a site called Ars Technica, and we covered all this stuff about people setting up these microwave connections.
Oh yeah.
On like not their land. It was like actually kind of, there were all these lawsuits and things. Cause
they were like, whoop, trying to sneak a little microwave. So yeah. Okay. Wait, we got to explain this to people. So if you've ever heard of high frequency trading, if you ever wonder why every time you go to, you know, buy your little, your 10 shares of Tesla or whatever, it always goes against you, right? Like the retail investor always seems to buy the wrong tick. There's so much computational power that you have no fucking idea of behind the scenes. Who owns this stuff? Well, it used to be me. It used to be me.
I trust you less now.
Right. Hey, at least I'm honest about
it. That's true.
So when I was building my business, I was bringing high frequency trading concepts, which is an equity trading, meaning stocks, concept. I was bringing that to the bond market, which is the pterodactyl fucking Tyrannosaurus Rex, old dinosaur bone market, where there isn't much computational power as compared to stocks. The volume's not there or whatever. You could, like, the bond market, you used to have to pick up the fucking phone. Let's put it that way, right? Okay. And you still had to pick up the phone while stocks were being traded computer to computer, right? So what I would do is to do what I was doing, which was low latency arb trading two things at once and picking off pennies, little tiny pennies. What I would do to get that done is I had to be the fastest gun in town. The fastest gun in town means in the milliseconds. We knew what our round trip time was to Chicago, and we knew what our round trip time was to whatever fucking exchange we were buying and selling from. Okay, how do you beat Goldman Sachs? Well, you know what their latency is from an approximation, and then we dig fiber and we basically sit right next to the exchange. And so maybe my screen doesn't reflect the trade as quickly, but it's been actually traded at a co-location center, meaning a bunch of servers, sitting really close to the exchange in Chicago. Now, if everyone wants to know how Nick Crown made his money a couple years ago, that's exactly how I fucking did it. Okay, I was faster than the next guy. Sorry, Goldman. You know, I gotcha.
They're very sad.
And now you know. Okay, back to the...
So we're like that, but for eyeballs. So the idea here is that if you do something in an app on your phone or on your desktop or even for your work app, when you click a button, you want something to happen and you want it to be instantaneous. And that's increasingly not true, particularly when you get to like Australia. And so the internet experience in Australia and Japan and India and Singapore is way worse than it is in the US.
Because of the water.
Yeah, because and it's just like literally light is slow. That's it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when and we can talk about why when you click something you expect something to happen. And by the way, if it doesn't happen, the conversion rates go
exactly. Yep.
Meaning, I don't want to wait. I'm not going to buy the football anymore.
Right. Right. And even more, I think that lately there's this expectation. I think we're getting kind of everyone has a much higher bar for what they want for all of their application experiences. To the point where it may not even be conversion related. It may be, does even actually engage with your application? Mm. Like, are people frustrated by it or not when they join?
Right. There's welcome to Miami, by the way.
Thank you.
There is a network of city bikes here.
Yep.
And these city bikes are one of the greatest things in the entire world because it's one of the few cities, if you're on the beach, that you take a city bike around, you can explore nature. You're probably not going to get hit by a vehicle the same way that you'd get hit by a vehicle in New York. Actually, I'm not guaranteeing that.
Right.
the skill of driving in New York is quite a bit, two standard deviations higher than the skill of driving here in Miami. But the bottom line is there is an app that powers the ecosystem of the city bike.
Yep.
And when I say it has lag in between every single action you take, it makes me almost not want to take that bike out, even though I'll enjoy the nature. One of the more frustrating things about having just meaningless lag, and this thing probably isn't even, I don't know. I don't know what it's doing. I don't know if it's communicating to a server. It's just built like shit. But the frustration of I press the button and it doesn't do the thing. As we move into the future, becomes more and more unacceptable.
Right, exactly. And what we basically offer is the easiest thing to do is move the server closer to people. You don't have to fix your app necessarily.
Move the box.
Yeah, and so we have servers in Miami. And if they were hosting, they're probably running in Virginia, which is 80, 90 milliseconds away round trip. So
right.
The human, apparently human perception is sub 100 milliseconds, looks instantaneous. And the reality is when you're dealing on the internet, like you want to get sub 40 most of the time. So most things are still sub 100 milliseconds.
I see.
So it's not like high frequency trading where it's like sub millisecond is really what you have.
Right.
It's still order, but it's still very fast.
Right. Right. The difference, by the way, why it would matter in high frequency trading is high frequency trading means if it's slow, it doesn't happen.
Right.
Whereas us, it's slow. It annoys us. We might click away, yep. But it still happened.
Probably, yeah. There's a little bit, you're right. There's a little bit of a reliability story there where slow and maybe broken are frequently look the same to like a device. But it's generally the frustration is the factor that people are after here.
Let's describe the architecture of AWS. AWS has mega hubs
yep.
throughout the US. And what you guys are doing is you have more granularity, meaning you have more micro hubs.
We something close to that. AWS is basically old school data centers moved to software in the same place. So each one of their cities is pretty much independent. It's very difficult to run a single application across all of AWS's regions.
Because you have to select, I want to run this out of the West Coast, the East Coast, New York 1, New York 2. And so what you're saying is, hey, we can simultaneously run this app across a variety of geography?
That's exactly right. It's basically one command to extend your app into a place like Madrid, for example, if you're doing a Madrid launch to go into that new market.
And nobody else is doing this?
Not in the way we are. I think the interesting thing about the problem space for us is there's a public company called Cloudflare.
I've heard of them.
They've kind of tackled the same problem in the wrong way. I think we're kind of confidently saying that at this point. I don't know if I would have said that so bluntly 2 years ago, but what we're actually doing is we're trying to make the apps that people are currently building work all over the world. And what Cloudflare is doing is trying to make you build entirely new applications that work specifically on Cloudflare.
Well, the thing with Cloudflare isn't Cloudflare like manually redirecting you somewhere else? They're like, hey, where are you? It takes a second, right? Where are you? I'm in New York. Oh shit, we're using the server from Los Angeles or whatever. Let's change you over to this other server. Is that how that Cloudflare is working?
They do some of it. I think the biggest, what they're actually doing, and where they started was from a security company. They protect your app against DDoS attacks and things, which you are on social media, you've probably been attacked by some random trolls on a Telegram group somewhere.
Which is just like traffic, spam traffic, hits onto your...
It's basically like sending you, 4,000 pounds of mail.
Yeah, which will blow up your mailbox.
Exactly. And then you have to filter through it, and you're probably going to miss the check that someone sent you.
Yeah.
Big problem.
I created, back in the day when I was a little kid, I created a little hacking program that would send people 4,000 pieces of email.
Oh, yeah.
Did you do that?
Oh, yeah. There's I feel like the little bit of naughty stuff is kind of the entry point to some of this. It's like, I want to try this. And then you get older and you're like, I was being an asshole. But that,
Well, having, I've spoken to so many YC alum that I had to start reading Paul Graham. Also, I just heard that Paul Graham was a really great writer. So yes. I read Paul Graham. I ripped through, was it Hackers and Painters?
Yep.
The collection of essays. And his argument is that naughtiness is a foundational tenet of being a hacker, meaning to even do this shit, you have to be naughty. Naughty is exploring boundaries.
Right.
It's exploring what's possible.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's discovering what you didn't know was possible is possible. So there's a beautiful thing about that. I've just recently, I think I mentioned my hacking programs on a pod a few weeks ago. I don't remember when it was. And I realized how important it was that I did that little stupid thing in my basement when my mom would get on the phone and you'd hear her coming through the modem.
Modem noises.
Remember that?
Nobody's going to know what you're talking about.
Oh my God. So the way a modem worked, you would share the line into your main family house with the computer. So if mom picked up the phone, you would, number one, get kicked off online.
The internet would just stop.
It would just stop. So whatever you're doing, which at that point, let's be honest, was not important.
Right.
At all.
No, it felt important.
It felt important. Like, come on. And then you'd get kicked off. And there was this weird phenomenon because I think the telephony, I don't know if that's the right word, in those days operated by sound.
Yep.
So like it was sending data with like sounds.
Roughly, yeah. That's like, exactly, yeah. Beep, beep, beep. So you'd hear the data. It was very strange.
You'd hear data.
Yep.
Unbelievable. What that also meant was you'd hear your mom pick up the phone and go like, hello?
Yep.
Hello?
And she'd hold the phone up to her head and it'd screech at her. And so she'd go like this, like immediately. It was slow as crap too. I remember when I went to college and had fiber optic. I was like, oh my God, this is the future.
Yeah.
And then you download all my wares.
Maybe one day I'll build it for everybody.
Yes. That I don't know when I started thinking that, but yeah.
When did you start thinking that?
I think this company is the first time I deliberately picked something that seemed big instead of trying to be scrappy.
Why did you decide to be big? Because you knew you could get away with it now?
I'll give you the artificial make me sound good reason.
No. Fuck that reason.
Well, okay. I was allowed to do something big because we've done something before and we had
agreed.
We didn't, we'd made money on the last company. Right. I had no mortgage. It was just like, it was pretty comfortable.
Yeah.
I think the reality is that I learned at the previous company that my personality is not a bootstrapping personality. I'm happier if I'm trying to push things as hard as they can go.
So you got away with being a bootstrapper, basically.
It was the only choice when we had no money and no connections. And like,
everyone forgets.
That's what I had to do. So, right. And I think the last company taught me a lot about myself that I didn't know was true. It's mm-hmm. like one of those was, I don't want to run a small company. I wanted to actually, I'm happier if I take on the biggest possible thing I can think of. And I'm happier with the idea of that failing that, and because I can do something else.
It's yeah.
like and then the stupid thing I learned was I thought I was the type of person that wouldn't like to look at me, or that I wouldn't like it. I didn't want attention from having like a nice car.
Uh-huh.
And then I got a nice car. I was like, oh, I actually do like it when people look at me in my car.
Wow. Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So you're like, it's one of those things because you can just say, hey, I'm lucky to have just been able to do the first thing. Let me not push my luck.
Yeah.
Let me not, tempt the fates. I'm just going to stay in my lane, or I'll do this the same way again. You're like, well, no, I recognized emotions through a discovery process, or
yep.
I actually want to run a big fucking company.
Yeah, that was I think that I actually explored being an investor because that's the stereotypical thing to do.
It is.
Hated that. Just not
really
the work I wanted to be doing.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God.
It's too boring.
It's boring. And it's so much of like, I think I'm pretty introverted. I'd rather build things than talk to people.
Yeah.
That's a rule. And investing is like, that's hard. Those people are doing hard work at all times. And no part of me got energy for that. So.
Well, because what everyone thinks an investor is this like in this ivory, like this beautiful mahogany office, ivory tower, just like, I'm the center of wisdom. It's like investors are fucking calling guys like you on the phone all day and asking them what's going on?
Yeah.
What are you guys doing? You
and sure I'm ignoring their emails and it's
you're ignoring them. They're trying to get a hold of you to decide if they're going to get their money back ever. It's a very interpersonal job. I mean, for the people that actually make a lot of money, for these people on TikTok that are like, come and see my Forex trade. It's like, no, dude, those people don't make any money because they don't have any fucking information. The whole
right.
Anyway, we're not going to go down that rabbit hole.
I got this company has been interesting because it's been a sequence. The whole reason I did Y Combinator, I did it in 2011, then we did it again in 2020. And the whole reason.
And you probably didn't need to do it.
It was surprisingly more useful than I thought.
Okay.
I was like, I know everything. And it turns out I don't.
So how was it useful?
I think the interesting thing there is the partners there have seen, now they see like 1,000 companies a year.
And so data set just gets big as fuck.
I had one company that went pretty okay and changed my life, but it was like pretty mediocre in startup terms. And they've seen everything and I've seen one. And so the interesting thing there was actually, I got to talk into a few times about some things that I was like, oh, we're going to do this. And they're like, that's stupid. Don't do that. And it was way more interesting than I expected.
So you have this kind of like godfather character in the room. That's like, I've literally seen you guys come and go every year. And that thing that you're about to do is a bad idea.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, Paul Graham I did office hours with him in 2011. And one of the things I remember him telling the company, a different company, not us, I was old and took it seriously. And there were a bunch of 20-year-old students who I was like, you're not taking this seriously. Like, this is my it.
Mm-hmm.
But he told one of them, he's like, this is why we fund so many companies. You can just drive yours off a cliff and we'll be fine. Because someone was just making kind of poor choices, it felt like, which I thought was super interesting.
Well, he's structuring to make the best possible environment, but he's still playing the numbers.
Right.
Meaning he hands a check to 1,000 people and 3 come back and pay for everybody else's
exactly.
fuck ups.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's even at the top, that's still the business model that seems to work.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was interesting about me not wanting to be an investor is our last round of funding. I live in Chicago and I just don't talk to investors because I don't want to. It's probably a bad thing. Like if the company wasn't working,
have had an exit. I'm assuming there's some bucks in the bag. You also kind of don't fucking feel like you have to do that.
Right. That's, yeah.
It's a maybe fuck you money type of thing that happens. Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. Actually, the best compliment I ever got was like, Kurt, your level of fuck you money is like $800. So I don't know how much of that I like to help versus I'm just like, don't like being told what to do. But this company, the fundraising of this company has been interesting, and it taught me how much I don't want to be an investor because first we failed to raise money at least twice that I can remember, which sucks. I hate it. It's like doing improv in Chicago, I've gone to auditions and been turned down. It's like equally terrible. It's the same.
Yeah.
Like just it sucks.
Well, it feels like someone's negating your identity.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the flip side of this was they started chasing us at one point, and I realized how hard they have to work for the companies that they think are special. When one of them, I wasn't responding. One of them finally emailed me a whole list of user interviews they'd done and said, I'm coming to Chicago. Can we eat and look these over? I was like, that's some sure.
Okay.
We'll just go right next door to where I'm working from and yeah. hang out. And then I told another one this was happening. And then 12 firms flew to Chicago that
Holy
week.
Holy shit.
I was like, oh my
it's
God.
It's a feeding frenzy.
It was. And you just saw them. They just dropped their whole life to come do this thing that I'm kind of like, that's bananas. Like, I don't know what's happening right now. This is never going to happen to us again.
Yeah.
But I don't want to do that. And that sounds terrible.
It does. It certainly does sound terrible. Well, there's so few good deals that when they see or they see social proof,
when they get conviction, that's their word.
Right. Whether it's true or not.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we've all seen these asinine things get funded with. I don't want to say asinine because it doesn't matter if I believe in the idea or not, but we see the wrong teams, yep. the wrong personalities. We see bravado in all the wrong directions and we're just like, this isn't going to work out.
Right.
We see that stuff happen all the time, but fundraising is a strange, freaky, nonsensical, bizarre little thing.
It is such a, the most interesting thing I've noticed with these is when they, and someone finally explained this to me, they're such herd animals. The investors are such herd animals about the next big market or the next big idea. And so crypto was that for a while, which was, I think, wrong. There's interesting stuff there. I don't think it's the next Facebook. And what I learned was happening was all of these firms felt like they'd missed social media back in like 2009, 2008 to 2012. And what they're all looking for is the market that makes the firm. And so crypto could have been that. And so you guys saw a ton of money in there. Now it's AI, which I think is probably more credible.
Way more credible. But yeah. Hey, I'm talking my own book.
Yeah. No, it's full of grift also, but it looks like a game.
At least it does your homework for you.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
It's like, I've done things with AI and like, wow, that's interesting. I have it edit my stuff now. Every time I write, I just run it through ChatGPT.
When's the last time Dogecoin did anything for you?
I don't know. I mean, if I owned any, maybe when Elon put it on top of Twitter.
That's fucking awesome. Dude, I just don't. I'm loving. He's like, I get an email the other day. Well, I guess everyone did. It's not like Elon. No, just
you specifically.
Yeah. Just me. He's like, by the way, Twitter is called X now.
I saw that. It's like,
just know that. So like we might still call Twitter, but just know that the parent company is called X and maybe it won't be called Twitter anymore. And just know that that's a thing now. And you're like, what the fuck? Like, it's amazing.
It's so entertaining. It's like so you're entertaining. Watching a train wreck half the time.
It's so entertaining. Oh, you know,
PayPal was called X. So maybe he's just trying to.
Well, we're going to go down a rabbit hole there.
No
Let's
crypto,
go back.
No Twitter.
No,
that's a whole talk by itself.
That's for someone else's podcast. That's for like an alpha male podcast.
No, I'd rather keep throwing shade at investors. I think that's much more interesting.
Yeah, let's keep going on this. Well, what we're exposing, and it's not to pick on investors, it's any industry where there's limited opportunity, they seem to cluster. And then you have to go and get the fucking deals. Yep. And if there's only a few deals and hey, you're like, wait, oh, everyone's talking about this company? Well, guess what? You're not going to get promoted if you don't fly down and get a piece of it for yourself. So can you blame these guys? It's the nature of the business. Right.
Right. It really is. And you could, I started figuring out who was talking to me just because they had to very quickly. It was super interesting.
Meaning my boss told me to come down here. That's why I'm here.
Or even I feel like I have to, and I'm not actually super into this, but I'm missing something. The FOMO stuff is, it's very... Investors are, I think it's a terrifying job because the fear of missing the thing means that you have to go look and decide against it or you're going to feel bad about it. It's not even not having a bite at the apple or whatever you want to call it is the biggest thing they're scared of.
Right. Because in the nature of the business of 1 to $20,000 bets, which is the roulette game, if you miss the thing, you don't. You basically miss a 30 to 40 years of of revenue and profit. Right. Like you've basically put yourself out of business.
Yep.
If you miss the one thing, you've put yourself out of business forever, technically, from a return.
There's there's a firm called Bessemer Venture Partners as an anti-portfolio that's worth reading because they talk about all their misses, and it's such a power move to be really? Like, we missed on Facebook, we missed on Slack, we missed on things, and we're still crushing it. I actually really like that they did that. And I think it says a lot about, cause it's not so much you can't miss the one, it's that you better find one of those. It's a really interesting set of incentives.
Right. You better find a one.
Exactly.
Whatever the fuck it is. Yeah. It doesn't have to be Facebook as long as it's something.
Yeah. And then you go back later and be like, oh, I missed out on Facebook. Stupid me. And then drive off in your Ferrari or whatever.
Right, exactly. Right. To go to a crawfish boil in New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly. Too bad for me.
Too bad for me. I guess I missed that one.
Wow.
So, okay. So you have this feeding frenzy moment. What happens, dude?
I learned a lot. I keep saying this. The most interesting thing is experiencing new stuff about startups for me. And I'm surprised how much new is happening in this one. So, with this in particular, one of the things that they were noticing was we just got really popular amongst developers on the internet for reasons entirely outside of our control. It wasn't anything we did at that point.
You guys went quote unquote viral amongst a niche community. Yeah,
we had an inflection point if you're an investor. You got to always draw the graph in the air when you say inflection
point. You're like, that's
hockey stick.
Good thing.
and so two things happened. One is investors love to tell you should be careful about your valuation because there's some truth to it, but it's not the most honest thing they can tell you, I don't think, while they're trying to get the deal.
They're like, you guys are being a little, but hey, after we give you the money, then we're going to fucking tell you that you were right all along.
Yeah. We got lucky. I got a very early offer from someone at a valuation I was happy with.
Okay.
And I just started telling everyone else that I'm not going to talk to them unless they're going to do like 2x that. It was just, it became a very interesting filter. And we ended up finding two people that liked that were like, yeah, this is, if it goes well, I'm not going to care, which I thought was very fascinating. So that was a thing I'm going to do now. I think if I ever, every time this happens, I'm like, oh, I'm never going to feel that again. Like having this feeding frenzy for my company, that's probably like a unicorn event. This is not ever going to happen to us again. Uh-huh. But if it did, I would definitely start pushing on them. I would actually try and filter investors early because I think that in some ways you're looking for the right person and not just the money. And I think that at our last company, we had some difficult times with a board member. And I think that that might've been partly why it was like a,
talk to me through what the right person looks like. So someone who is a providing an insight that perhaps you might not have.
Right.
They have.
I think there's the first do no evil problem, which is investors can really screw a company.
I mean, just
up.
Stay the fuck out of the good stuff.
It's like neutral is a good start. So let's not mess anything up.
Okay.
And I think a lot of that has to do with their kind of, have they like consumed the Kool-Aid thing, both in terms of what you think the market is, how the product should work, and then also how you expect to sell it. This is where I've run into problems the most, is we have a very strong take on how this should be sold, how the go-to-market should happen. And for us, finding investors that had thoroughly bought into that idea was very important because it's very different than what some of them would prescribe. It's very different from what some of an Oracle would say to do. And it's both right for us and also right for me. Doing the other thing would be very awkward. It wouldn't work. And so that was, at our last company, it was a little bit of that problem. We had a thing that I thought was working. It was, we had like a plan for the next couple of years. It seemed like this was working the way we wanted it to. And it was never right for the investor. And so that's the do no evil thing. It's like, at the very least, like just be, you're a cheerleader. You got to be happy with us. You have to know we have more context than everyone else.
Right.
You're not running a company because you're probably too scared. That's not the nice thing to say.
That's fighting words.
Yeah, exactly. And then
well, it's a different skill set.
It is.
That's like owning a supermarket and then assuming that you can duck behind the butcher counter and take a cow down.
Exactly.
And turn it into a porterhouse.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, it, like, dude, come on.
Yeah.
Don't kid yourself.
It's
And hey, let's be honest. It's a just as the same that the butcher who's broke the cow down shouldn't go and run the grocery store.
Probably not. Not yet. Maybe
not yet.
Someday.
I don't know.
It'll develop. It seems like it's more likely to go that direction than the other one.
You're actually 100% right. Oh man, that's really interesting. okay. Sorry. This is beautiful. Yes, you're probably right there. Okay, so I completely see why this makes sense. It's what's funny is like these are those moments where you're like, you don't have too many at bats when 12 people show up. Like, it's not like you go, I know how this goes.
No.
12 people always show up trying to hand me millions of dollars.
I don't know what I'm supposed to do right now.
You're like, I don't even know what, should I be polite? Should I be pissed? Should I be distant? Should I play hard to get? I don't even know what you're supposed to do.
No, I don't either. And I'm not even sure I still do. I was just, because we didn't need them. I think that the most powerful thing ever is just not needing them.
Yeah.
And
well, in life, just not needing whatever it is.
Exactly.
Is the power move.
And it's not even a thing I can fake. Like if I legitimately
don't think you can fake it.
It's I know you're supposed to act it, but I'm like, I've never acted it unless it's been true.
Yeah.
And I think that we put off the vibe of like, we're happy to talk to you, but this is not important right now.
Right.
And I think it made some of them feel like there was a chance to really pitch themselves to us, which was good. But I don't know how to go next time. I don't know if there will be a next time. Right. That's the weirdest dynamic difference between investors and founders.
Right. They have perhaps hundreds of at-bats. Yeah,
this might be my last one. I may never get to do this again.
Yeah.
And they're going to look at 40 companies this year.
And they're going to fly in and have to take you out to lunch and do the same, you know. They're used to it. It's their armchair moment.
Yeah.
For you, you're like, I don't even know what the fuck is happening right now.
And I'm probably not doing something I feel like is important because I'm doing this instead. That's the thing that's always been a struggle for me.
Right, right. So what, you end up finding the right partner through this moment?
Yes. And I think one of the things I've since learned, I used to think investors are either harmful or neutral and there wasn't a lot of upside. I think that there are a few that are really well connected and in a way that's relevant to us. I think one problem they have is they all have their networks. And if their network isn't important to our business, it's actually not useful. But we found a few now that have very, very good connections into the types of places we want to talk. They have very good connections in the type of people we want to hire, which has been, that's new again.
Right. It's not just cut me the check. It's like, well, what other businesses that use this type of infrastructure would be interested in working with us?
And we have one who's aggressively pitching us as like basically trying to sell us to companies. It's like, oh, obviously investors should do that. That is a thing to look for.
Right.
It's like, how much are you going to push us to companies that you think it's not even again, not fake. He's entirely bought in. He genuinely believes all the companies should be using us.
Right.
But it was a first for me seeing someone like, basically overwhelm me with leads was very interesting.
That's fantastic. It's because basically what they're doing is they're saying, hey, here's some money and the rest of it will come from customers.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah,
exactly.
That's spectacular.
It's actually it's a loop. It's like, here's some money. When we see it from customers, there'll be more money. So we're shipping GPUs right now for, which is what all the AI companies need to do generative AI basically. And investors have been pushing us to do that. They're like, we think the market needs it. It's expensive. We got your back. I was like, okay, cool. Let's give that a try. It's a good big swing.
The bottleneck to AI is computational power.
Yeah. And it's specific. It's actually a different kind of, since it's the GPUs, and I'm not even technical enough to explain deeply why this is all this different, but it's actually the type of computational power that people haven't needed for hosting their apps historically.
Can you, when we think of CPU versus GPU, that's what we're talking about here?
Yeah, and I think the best way to think about it is CPUs are very general purpose and you could do a lot of AI stuff on it. It would just take years. And GPUs are very specialized, it's much faster. It's like orders of magnitude faster than running the same workloads on CPUs.
Right.
And for things like OpenAI, they're talking about doing like trillions of iterations on things at this point. Like it has to happen, and it's still going to take them 6 months, basically. So,
wow. So everyone is using ChatGPT, right? So let me give you a little bit of an advanced technique. It's one tick further than the ChatGPT, right? The slang is called multi-shot. You give it a few examples, and then give me the third, give me the fourth, give me the fifth, however many examples. And guys, you can do this. If you have an OpenAI API account, you apply for one. It's not expensive if you get access to it. I think it's probably gated now. I have it through, obviously, my AI company.
But yeah.
You should be able to get this thing. Okay?
Yeah, it seems pretty available.
Yeah. It's now, what's going to happen is there's something called the playground, the sandbox environment. This is where it's kind of like your old friend ChatGPT, but now you can prompt it in more complicated ways. You can provide a lot more context. And basically what you're going to do here is this thing called multi-shot. So if you have a style of writing or you have these ideas and you have previous examples of your own ideas,
right,
you can basically say, I did this this way. I did this this way. I did this this way. Maybe you categorize them and you say, do it again.
Right.
Kind of like how the way that I did it.
Yep.
And it's a non-code, really quick and cheap and dirty way to get output that miraculously mirrors your syntax, your tone, your, I think multi-shot is where it's at for the armchair AI person.
We actually, we do a bunch of take-home hiring exercises and we've run them through basically that process to let it generate responses for us to see how good they can be.
Oh, wow.
Because I'm actually, I feel like the, I feel like this is a difficult problem to solve for companies when they're hiring, is to actually find a human who's doing things. If you kind of give people a thing that the AI can solve for them.
Certainly now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So like any writing sample, I think is at risk of being ChatGPT generated.
Sure.
But we were lucky because we fed it a bunch and its responses wouldn't have passed. So I was like, all right, I feel better about that. I'm sure it won't always be that way.
Right.
But that was fun. I think we've been thinking about feeding it actual responses that we think are good and seeing how far we can push it.
Okay.
But it's kind of a scary thing.
Scary and also
exciting. I mean, it's scare sighting. It's both of those.
You're like, I'm so scared, but I'm so happy.
It's like, I have no idea what's going to happen right now, but yeah. I'm generally optimistic.
Basically. It's that Saved by the Bell episode where Jesse takes, I think, caffeine pills.
Yep.
And she says, I'm so excited. I'm so excited. I'm so scared.
I want to mention that you're dating yourself with these references and then I understand
it,
them.
Dude.
So it's all over.
I don't give a shit. Okay. One of the greatest scenes in television history.
That's a take. That's a good take.
Well, the whole thing about that was they were actually trying to genuinely educate the audience on drugs, and they realized that they couldn't have Jesse take drugs. Right. So she takes caffeine pills and has this,
which is actually on the nose because caffeine is terrible.
Terrible.
Terrible. It's
terrible.
Like actually an awful drug.
Yeah.
We're just okay with it.
Yeah. So Jesse takes this caffeine pills to study for, I believe, they're in like high school, but they have a final exam. I don't know what it is, right? And she has a complete crash meltdown. And I grew up to that.
Yep.
So here I am.
And probably never took drugs because of it.
And probably never took drugs because of it. We're going to stick with
just
that.
Just like dare.
Yeah, exactly. I never tried it. That's a rabbit hole too. It's like, when I grew up, an officer would come to your school and tell you if you smoke weed, you're going to die. And now it's like, Mom, I made $1 million from selling pre-rolls.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, what the fuck is going on?
Dare is so problematic in hindsight. Like, you think back, it's like, that is such an interesting thing that they tried to do.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting thing they tried to do. And then it just became completely irrelevant within our lifetimes, making me just question even more about the nature of reality that I engage with every day and just,
right.
You know, you're
it's
like,
all going to change.
How much wasted time and energy, by the way, this is not me saying that this cannabis, like I'm like into the cannabis industry or this is like, I just think it's ludicrous. We spend half of our life learning that this is the thing that's going to kill you. So have friends go to jail and now they sell it at the fucking Kmart down the street.
Well, you've still got football players in Texas getting arrested for weed. Which is really weird because it's so different by state.
Right.
I think it was like a Texas A&M player got arrested like last week. And I was like, for what now? And it was weed. And it was like, must have been selling. It was like a joint. It was like just not much. It was really interesting.
Right. And meanwhile, you know, you go a few thousand miles and you can go to the store that looks like the Apple store and buy friggin' whatever.
Expensive lighting.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like under shelf lighting.
No, you just stop on the way home from work.
Right.
Along with everyone else stopping on the way home from work.
Exactly.
Drive-throughs. Yeah.
Yeah. But in me growing up, you know, it's just like you're just getting pulled over and they're using a microscope to look through your car.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, how do you know that's not like a pine cone?
Don't care.
Don't care. You're coming with me.
Yeah. You seem
the suburbs.
Very much.
The suburbs.
Yeah. I think you're all the same. It's all like the small town cops next to a big city.
Yeah. Well,
other rabbit hole police experiences over the last 40 years.
Well, you know what's interesting is Paul Graham. I don't know if you read the essay about the public school system in the United States. Paul Graham goes like way into this and he changed my mind.
Really?
Yeah. Paul Graham is like basically the public school system And the suburb system is not designed to educate. It's designed to just warehouse young, unruly people in the safest way, meaning a jail-like environment, possible. So keep them busy, keep them confused, and keep them under lock and key until they become big enough to follow the rules of society. Conformity and the pressurized environment that the American high school is. His example is, I can't think of anything more ridiculous than watching an oblong ball go across a field. Because for those who don't know, Paul Graham is from the UK and had moved from the UK. So anyway, he sees this from this distance. And I think it was just really beautiful to overlay my own life and my own, you know, these things you take for granted. You're like, this is pretty random shit.
Yeah.
And it's pretty ineffective shit. Yeah. So the DARE program being one of the weirder, you know, loaded aspects of that. But just everything about the stress and terror. I don't know. Did you have a lovely high school experience? Or?
No, my experience probably fits what he's explaining, which has been over the course of my life. I've been like, school sucks for people like me. However, we've adopted a bunch of kids from different backgrounds. And one of the things that we've now learned is that school's actually very good for some kids, particularly with behavioral issues, public schools especially. And it's not the same as what he's talking about. School didn't help me be successful. I don't think it was kind of a pain, and I wasn't good at it, and I didn't do homework, and I'm lucky I did okay on tests, I guess. Right. But I think for what's been interesting with my kids is watching what it actually is good for. And when kids deal with certain problems among their peers, or if they're autistic or have dyslexia or any number of other things,
right?
My desires for them have changed. It's not, I want them to be the next Mark Zuckerberg or whatever. I guess that's not even who you want them to be this year anyway.
God, Jesus Christ.
My references.
What a terrible example.
I know. I'm sorry.
At least use Elon Musk.
Yeah, right. No, even that's no.
Wait a second. I mean, Bill Gates. Too. Wait, no.
God, what's wrong with these people? Who do I want them to be? I don't know.
The mattress king of Chicago.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. So far, I don't have any huge negatives for that one. So
just wait.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Just wait till you see his fly list, his travel list.
Exactly. But it's changed for us from like, I just want them to be, have a chance to be successful at living at all. And it's not production based, which I think is I think a lot of very smart people want to tackle the school system. And the thing I've learned about having kids that aren't just like me is just how diverse the problem is for people. We were going to put our kids in private school, and they actually turned us down. Mm-hmm. We sent them for interviews, and they're like, no, this isn't. They told us one of our fifth grader at the time. They're like, she just doesn't seem like she wants to learn. I was like, oh my God, she's in fifth grade.
Yeah. What the fuck do you know?
What does that even
asshole
mean? Yeah, exactly. So public school for us right now, because it's actually the best system for our particular kids' needs, which has been, it's tempered some of my more libertarian school takes.
Okay. Right. Because obviously when you're reading essays from Paul Graham, they're written by Paul Graham.
Paul Graham and his wife, Jessica, and they're really high functioning children that are going to be fine regardless of
what happens.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really interesting set of problems, I think, that when we sold the last company, I went back and talked to the investors I had. I was like, I'm going to do ed tech. They're like, dump. Everyone tries to do an education
and blows it up.
And you don't know what you're doing. Yeah. And it won't work. Do something. Stay in your lane was the quote I got, which was kind of funny. Because I think everyone who makes money wants to fix education for younger them.
Yeah. And undo the shit show that was their experience. Yeah. I bridged the gap between not fitting in at all. My best friends kept moving away. It's like every time I had a best friend, they moved away. He's like, oh, it's to Detroit.
That gets a little old.
I'm like, well, this sucks. And I was like on the fence of being kind of on the nerd side, but also I played lacrosse. I didn't play football. I played a sport no one gave a shit about. People started to care a lot more about it as it became more popular. But I was like, I never really fit in, man.
Right.
And I still don't, except then I cared. Now I don't. That's the difference.
Yeah.
So if you're listening to this and you're like, school sucks, gets better. And quite frankly, it doesn't really matter.
No, you get better. You get better at coping with it is pretty much what happens.
Yeah.
So when I started improv in Chicago, it's funny because I'm 43 now. I started when I was like 37, and it's still basically classes full of 22-year-olds that want to go on SNL.
Yep.
And even it was exactly the same schools. Like, these people are very different than me. They're after very different things. I'm nowhere near as good at them at what I want to be doing right now. It was a lot of repeats of that. And it's the same way. I just don't, in this case, I could talk myself into not caring. There's still a part of me that's like, I want these people to like me, and I want to be good at what I'm trying, but I've gotten much better at just not being good at stuff, which I think is maybe a good skill. Or makes my life easier.
Accepting us for who we are as the strange, it's unique,
very, very Christian.
Perhaps it's just, you let yourself off the hook a little bit.
Yeah,
dude.
I think that's probably the,
you know, you don't have to be the guy that's got the coolest jeans and the also throws the fucking touchdown pass and all this shit. It's like, you know, if you could go back and tell your high school self, don't worry, I'm going to sell a company to fucking IBM.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm okay with that story.
You know what? And the whole time, my brain's still just screaming at me. It wasn't like nothing about how I felt about life changed because of the events. It was just that I had a new set of events to react to.
Right. Well, listen, man, this is one of those, this is a slow burner, because now I feel like we're on fire and we've got a hard stop as usual. Oh man, I wish I could stay here and talk to you more, because now we're getting into the real meat of it.
Oh yeah.
I was going to say, keep me up to date on what's going on with Fly.io, but the truth is, if it works, you won't fucking have to.
Right. That's fair.
I'll just be moving my servers over to you, and that'll be that. Yeah. Right. And I'll wave at you like from a distance. Just be like,
hopefully I'm still accessible.
Yeah. I'll just wave towards your general vicinity through the guards. And
just know I'm probably dying inside because I didn't like my improv class that day.
Exactly.
Like, regardless of how it looks from the outside.
Right. Priorities are still priorities.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, man. Kurt, thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is great.
See you soon.